Okay, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Bickman back to Toronto. I think you were here about 4 years ago, three, 4 years ago, when he actually spoke on an issue that's become very, very heated issue in Israel again, the issue on Koalisha, which he wrote the tshuva about. But he's here tonight to speak on Hellenism, of course, a week before Hanukkah. Rabbi Bickman was born in Detroit. He learned in Skokie, Illinois, and I think as a young Bnei Akivanik, made Aliyah in 1976 to Kibbutz Ma'ale Gilboa, where he still lives 35 years later. He was the Rav. He learned, while he was in Israel, he learned in Merkaz HaRav and in Netzach Yisrael, Harav Gusman, the Rosh Yeshiva, those who may know of him. And he served as the rabbi in the kibbutz in Ma'ale Gilboa. And since, I believe, 1995, he's been the Rosh Yeshiva. Yeshivat has there in Ma'ale Gilboa. It's a pleasure to welcome him back to Toronto. Harav Bickman, bakasha.
What we're going to talk about tonight are two thinkers of the 20th century and the way they relate to Hellenism. Of course, when they relate to Hellenism, they are not relating to Hellenism per se. They are really speaking about Western civilization. So we are not going to be talking about Hellenism in the historic sense, but rather Western civilization that in their eyes stems from Hellenistic culture. And the two thinkers are connected, but we are going to do the last first. So we are first going to talk about the thoughts of Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner. How many people have heard of him? Actually, not bad. So I'll give a short introduction. He was a brilliant student at the Yeshiva Slobodka. And at a very young age, he published a work of Chidushim on Masechet Nazir and became very famous at a very young age. The Slobodka Yeshiva was probably the most important yeshiva of the Musar movement at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And it's the head of the yeshiva, who was not the Rosh Yeshiva, whose name was Natan Tzvi Finkel. Maybe that name means something to you because his great-grandson just passed away about, I think it was about 3 weeks ago. They called him the Saba. Many of the Musi Yeshivot had figures that were called the Saba. There was a Saba Mikel. Anyway, he was called the Saba Mislobodka, and he thought that the key to proper education was the concept of Kvod Adam, or Gadlut Adam. I mention this because it has an effect on Rav Kuttner. He thought that one must respect himself as created in the image of God and one's other. The other was created in the image of God. If you read his drashot, you will see that he very often uses figures that are not Jewish, taking from Tanakh or from Agadah. And in the end, he will say something like, Kol Shekein Yisrael Shenikru Banim Lamakom. So he has this kind of universal idea that man's being created in the image of God is the key issue in education. This is usually compared to the Vardok, where they thought that being humble was the most important thing, and he actually thought that one should play up the little bit of an ego trip in a certain sense. In fact, he also... The guys would dress very properly to express this. And eventually, he founded a branch of the yeshiva in Hebron, in Eretz Yisrael, which became the major branch of Slobodka. And Rav Kuttner then moved on to Hebron as well. By the way, if you see a picture of the guys in Hebron before the massacre, they almost all are wearing white suits or very light suits and flat straw hats. Very stylish, which was an expression of the Saba's idea that Bachrei Yeshiva should think of themselves as being created in the image of God. And when I was a Yeshiva student, we would say all that's left of the great idea of the Saba, of the greatness of man, is a fancy hat. Migbat b'shnutzutzachat, we would say in Hebrew. That was all that was left over from the great idea. This is very important because it has a lot to do with Rav Huttner. But Rav Huttner, when he was in Eretz Yisrael, he came in contact with Rav Kook. The first time I came across Rav Huttner's writings, which I will describe in a minute, I said, wow, he has probably read very much, he's read a lot of Orot HaKodesh, the monumental work that was edited by the Nazir, Rav Kook's Talmid, and I had no idea that he'd actually learned with Rav Kook and was strongly influenced by Rav Kook. So we are going to first study the Samis of Vodka, and then we're going to work a little on Rav Kook's ideas about Hellenism today. Rav Huttner started sometime in the 60s speaking to his students, and these talks were then I think the talks were in Yiddish. I heard one, I think it was about 1980. I heard one talk, he eventually came on Aliyah, and I heard a talk of him in Mattersdorf. He gave a talk, it was in Yiddish, and they were transcribed into Hebrew, apparently by his daughter. There are some questions about who actually did it. Apparently his daughter was very active in transcribing the works into, translating them and editing them and putting them into Hebrew. Okay, so we're gonna work on one drasha where he talks about Hellenism. The way these are set up is that he's giving a shiur like you would hear in a Litva Yeshiva. He gives three or four questions. One question will be the clincher, which will create a need to revamp our thoughts about something. And the problem that he's concerned with, which is also the problem that concerns Rav Kook, is the ambivalence that we find in our source material towards Hellenistic culture or Greek culture. It's usually intertwined in these source materials. You know that Professor Lieberman wrote a book which is called in English, I'm not so sure, it's called in Hebrew, even though it was written in English, but I read it in Hebrew, it's called Yevanim V'Yavnut Be'eretz Yisrael. Does anybody know Professor Lieberman's first
Greek and Jewish Palestine?
Where are we?
Greek? No, it's not in the text yet. Greek?
Greek and Jewish Palestine.
Greek and Jewish Palestine is what it's called. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Greek and Hellenism, I think, isn't it? At any rate, Professor Lieberman discusses in his book all the different source material relating to Hellenistic culture and shows that there's a multitude of approaches. And if we look at this issue in a historical way, we would probably say different periods, different people. And that's why we have in our source material this ambivalence, depending on who said the statement and when they said the statement. But both Rav Huttner and Rav Kook before him are not concerned with the historical aspect, but rather what we can make of all of this as readers in the 20th century. So then, I will now describe the questions that Rav Huttner asked at the beginning of his drasha, and then we will read his solution. Okay, so the first question that he asks is, you have it on your page if you want to see the text, but we're not going to, it's on page, how are the pages? How are the pages marked here? The one that's Pachad Yisrael Ma'amar Dalid. The first question he asks is the following. He says, we have many, in the Talmud, we have many, many commandments which are Drabbanan. And only one time in Shas do we have a sugiyat that discusses the authority of mitzvot drabanan at great length. We'll talk about that great length. But the sugiya asks the question, after the Gemara asks the question, what bracha we make when we light the Hanukkah candles, the Gemara says, Asher kidishanu mitzvotav v'tzivanu ladlik ner Hanukkah, Asher kidishanu mitzvotav v'tzivanu, and then the Gemara says, ve'chan tzivanu, where were we? And then the Gemara discusses what authority is behind the mitzvot Rabbanan. So Rav Huttner's first question is, why does the Gemara discuss this at length only in this particular instance, Nerot Chanukah? Okay, the truth of the matter is that the great length here is two lines instead of one. There are two opinions in the Gemara in Shabbat, and all other places only one opinion is mentioned. But that's what Futter says. It's discussed at great length. So that's the first question he expresses. The second question is a literary question as well. And the question is, why does it say in Al HaNisim, Lashkichem Toratecha Ulahavirem Mechukei Rutzonecha, that the Greeks wanted to their purpose was to make us forget the Torah and not keep the laws of the Torah, transgress the laws of the Torah. Then Rav Hunter says, well, the way to forget the Torah would be to make us forget the Torah would be to forbid us to learn Torah. So why is it everything, and to learn Torah is a mitzvah. So if we said, lahavirei mechukei ritzonecha, that would be enough to include the forgetfulness of the Torah. If the Greeks would not allow us to learn, we would forget the Torah. So why is forgetting the Torah mentioned separately? This is a question which is a lead-on question. Very often our Futter asks these kind of questions to lead us into a certain kind of thought. He's trying to lead us into the thought that forgetting the Torah in conjunction with Greek culture or Hellenistic culture is something deeper than just what he would call a gzerah. What'd you say, gzerah? A decree. There's something deeper going on here, okay? And then the third question that he asks, which is the question, the clincher, is the fact that our source material is very ambivalent regarding the Greek culture. So his example is that the only other language you can write the Torah in other than Hebrew is Greek. Quoting the Pasuk, and the Gemara uses this as the reasoning. For some reason, the nations that are mentioned in Bereshit over the generations have been associated with many nations. When you see the list there, over generations, people have associated those names that appear in Bereshit with various nations. But one that's stuck from the very beginning for some reason is Yefet and Yavan. Like, that's multi-generational association. I don't know what the basis for that. Why Chazal thought that Yefet had something to do with Yavan. But in any case, so Chazal said the only language you can write the Torah in other than Hebrew is Greek. There are, if you would look at Professor Lieberman's book, you will find there are many examples of a positive relationship to Greek culture other than that particular one. But that is a very obvious one. There are others as well. And of course, there are all the negative ways that Chazal look at Greek culture. And then he says, then Rav Hunter says one other important thing that will lead us forward. And he says, when we talk about people who have left the fold, so to speak, over the generations, we call them kofrim, minim, apikorsim, which he views as, let's take fira. And he says, that's different than this particular instance because here we give them a special name. What's the special name? In Hebrew we say mityavnim. In English we would say Hellenist. So he looks at this, he says, what is a kofer? A kofer is somebody who negates the Torah. So a Hellenist is not only someone who negates the Torah, but there's something there. Right? In yeshiva we would say, yes, there's something chiyuvi. Maybe it's a psul chiyuvi. In other words, there's a difference between if you have 1, 0, and -1. It's not clear whether it's negative or positive, but the fact that you call them mityamim means that there is something there. Okay? And the final point he makes before he actually describes what he views as the Hellenistic culture is that when two things are close together, two cultures or two streams of thought are close together but have a difference, animosity is much greater. Does anybody have any good examples? My examples are really old-fashioned ones. I'll give you my example, but maybe you can think of a better one. My example is, I lived in Geula for 2 years, just after I was married. So who are the worst enemies of the Eidah Haredit? Who would you think? The Aguda, somebody knows, the first person that ever asked the question. Of course, the Aguda are their worst enemies because they're just like them, but they accept government funding for their schools. Who are the worst enemies historically of the Aguda? The Mizrahi. The Mizrahi doesn't exist anymore so much. But when the Mizrahi existed, they were the worst enemies of Aguda, and so on and so forth. Or when I asked the girls at the Midrashah in Enatzi, for many years I'd asked the question, I said, who's the daughter that gets along least with mom? They always answered, the one who's most like her. Invariably, I don't know if that's always true, but the girls always have the same answer. It's always the daughter that's most like mom that gets along least with her. So, Rav Werder points out that when there's a difference and the two things are close, then there is great animosity. Okay, so now after all that buildup, we know, if you've read Rav Werder for many years, you would know that he's leading up to something very ambivalent. There must be something positive about Hellenistic culture, in this case, Western culture, but there also is some kind of deep drawback that we have to be aware of. Okay, so now we're going to read the paragraph in which he tries to solve all this ambivalence, and we'll see whether it's pertinent. So we're going to read, hey, okay? V'hine Ratzon Hashem mitgalenu b'shtei marachot. The will of God expresses itself and reveals itself in two systems. You can help me with the translation. I'm not very good with translations. Maracha achat b'maseh b'reishit b'olam sh'nivra b'asara ma'amorot. One place that it reveals itself is the creation of the world that was created with 10 sayings. Chazal quote, always say Asra Ma'amarot, rather than 6 days, Asra Ma'amarot, because it says Vayomer 10 times. And that makes a very nice comparison with something else that we have, where we have 10. Umaracha Shniya Ba'amar Har Sinai B'Torah Shnitna Ba'Aseret HaDibrot. And the second place that God reveals himself is at Sinai, when he gave the 10 commandments. So we have 10 verses 10. Okay. Idi Gilui Ratzono Shemakom Hei. They are both revelations of God's will. Ela sheyesh hevdel pnimi ba'ofen yitziatam min hakoach el hapoal. But there is a great difference in the way actualize themselves from potential to realization. The ratzon Hashem amitkadem b'maseh b'reishit ba'ofen kiyumo. The way that God's will reveals itself in creation is through force. It's determined. Hechrach. I don't know if I can translate that. Can somebody help me with that? Is there a better word for hechrach? Jay? Forced into it, something like that. Ve'ilu ratzon Hashem amitgaleh b'Torah ofen kiyumo b'derech b'chira. The will of God, as in the Torah, is only through freedom of choice. Yehi or, look at these wonderful examples. Yehi or, zeh ma'amar mitkeim, ke b'derech chok mitziut shechach. When Hashem said, let there be light, then there automatically is light. But when Hashem said, lo tishtachaveh, when Hashem said, lo tishtachaveh, zohi, Dibra hamitkemet b'derech chirut ratzon shel b'chira. But lo tishtachaveh, God can say lo tishtachaveh as much as he wants, but if people don't listen to that, it won't happen. Okay? In other places, Rav Huttner's examples are different than this example. Why did he choose these two examples, Yihor and lo tishtachaveh? Not, you know, let there be light and don't bow down to idols. Chanukah. Okay, but what Rav Huner is very often is concerned with is not Loti Shtachavah, but rather Loti Tzach. Just like most thinkers in the second half of the 20th century, their concern is Loti Tzach because of the Shoah. But he uses these two examples because they're appropriate for Hanukkah. Because even if Hashem says Loti Shtachavah or Loti Tzach, if that is the divine will, it doesn't have any impact on our lives unless we human beings decide to fulfill that commandment. So here we have God's will revealed in two ways. One is the given way. And the other is that which is dependent upon us. Okay, does anybody want to take it from here? So then we have two cultures. One culture is concerned with the given world. And the other culture is concerned with the world that has to be created by human choice. Which is which? So that's very clear. So what is Hellenistic culture for, Rav Huttner? What part of Western civilization is the continuation of Hellenistic culture? What aspect? Science. Science is the, for Rav Huttner, is the continuation of Hellenistic culture. And science is wonderful because science is a discussion of, is a human attempt to fathom the will of God as it expresses itself in the act of creation. Okay, the human attempt, as Stephen Hawking said in a short history of time, a brief history of time, he said, strange statement, he said, after he shows that he was probably wrong when he thought there was actually proof for the Big Bang, and there may not be proof, he said, and these are his words, and now God willing, with a capital G, we may start to understand his, with a capital H, creation, after he realized that he doesn't have a proof for the Big Bang. But science is the attempt to understand his creation. So that seems wonderful. And Yadut, the Torah, is concerned with behavior, moral behavior. Rav Huttner wrote at a time when people didn't think of Torah as having a dichotomy with ethics. Okay? So that might be hard for us in a certain sense, because we think of certain issues in which it would appear to us that there is a conflict or a dichotomy. But I have to admit, when I was a Bachur Yeshiva at the time that Rav Huttner was writing these things, when I was a Yeshiva student, I also didn't think of it. It was just a natural thing. For me, the Torah was good, and ethics and Torah went together. And it's also typical thought of the Musar movement. So we have to put that aside. If we think of Torah as being opposed in any way to ethics, we can't understand Rav Huttner. He doesn't have that mindset. I don't know if he could have that mindset. Because we have all these issues in our minds, like woman's position in Yadut, or we have, it's much better in Hebrew, you would say the Aguna issue, I would say Misrovot Get, which is a more, right? Recalcitrant husbands. We have all these issues in our mind that sort of, or when I was growing up in Detroit, I don't know what it's like, I think it's probably about the same in Toronto, we had a lot of differences between the various segments of the Jewish community, but all the Bachwei Shiva, all the Yeshiva students were always seemed like fine people, even though we had this bickering, right? We would have these arguments, but everybody seemed like a fine person. I never thought of that I would ever see a Yeshiva student being violent towards another human being. It was beyond my horizon at that time. I think those are the people, that's Rav Huttner's mindset. He doesn't think of these things. So that is something we have to put aside when we're discussing Rav Huttner, that problem. For him, Torah and ethics are one. Or Torah is the pinnacle of ethics. Like the Natsiv, who says, first we have Chovat HaAdam, and after we have Chovat HaAdam, the general human, our responsibilities as human beings, upon that we have the responsibility of the Torah. As a second story upon the foundation, once you have the foundation of Chovat HaAdam, then you have the Torah beyond that. So he never thought of it being in conflict with Chovat HaAdam. It was simple to him, to the Natsiv, that it was a continuation of Chovat HaAdam, of man's responsibility, of basic ethics. So we have to put that aside. So where does Rav Huttner see that, where the problem is? By the way, he makes a judgment statement at the end of this paragraph. Maybe we'll read that together. No, I'll just explain it. It'll be better. He says that one is the purpose of the other. In other words, he says that the Torah or ethics are the purpose of creation. Okay, so that's also, the modern people might not think of it that way, or contemporary people, because that would mean that we have to save the polar bear, but not for his own sake, but only because it's our responsibility and our ethical behavior is important. We may have a responsibility. If we have ecological responsibility, it won't be because the polar bear is there for us, not vice versa. Even if it plays itself out in the same exact way. In other words, you might do everything the same way, but he assumes that the creation is the basis for our morality and human morality is the pinnacle or the purpose of creation. Okay, lulei, im lo briti yomam v'layla chukot shemayim v'aretz lo samti. Klomar, this is the last sentence in the fifth paragraph, in Hey. Klomar lo nitgal kodesh baruch hu matan chera ki im lamsi makom litgalut b'matan cherut. Hashem did not create the world, the given world, but only in order that we reveal the more important world, which is the world of ethical behavior, that Hashem's will is that there be an ethical world, but that is dependent upon us. That's the purpose of creation. The first time I taught this to a group of non-religious Israelis, kibbutznik asked me, she said, Rav Huttner is a chauvinist. It's not the usual connotation. He's a chauvinist for humankind. When I went home, I said, wait a minute. All these people, they had fly traps at that time. I was wondering if she had a fly trap in front of her home. Right? But that was her complaint about Rav Huttner. It was a long time ago, like 15, 20 years ago. She said, Rav Huttner is a chauvinist for humankind, vis-a-vis the animal kingdom. So, okay. That might be so. But in any case, I think the Torah in Breshit Aleph, at least, is like that. Maybe in Breshit Bet not, because in Breshit Aleph, man is the pinnacle of the creation. But in Breshit Bet, the man is created lo v'dao l'shomra. So maybe it's dependent on Breshit Aleph and Breshit Bet, which way you look at it. I don't know. Okay, so where's the problem? So now let's read about the problem, because this problem you may find very relevant. Vav. V'zoa malach lazmir la'atzmenu et varav shal amaral ki avanim mitnagdim hem l'Yisrael davka mitzad koch hachma miyuchal yavan. So this is our opportunity to explain what the Maral says, that the problem of Yavan vis-a-vis Israel is davka specifically because of their wisdom. כלומר, מפת ריבוי דבקות נפשם של יוונים בחוכמת הטבע, אשר זה עיקר עניינה של חוכמת יוון, since the purpose of the Hellenistic culture was to talk about science and nature, because of that, they נשתתלה בהם הספקריה שאחריה. They became deterministic in their outlook towards life. Okay, so he says that because Western culture is concerned with science and nature, then they became obsessed with deterministic ideas. So now we're going to do this twofold, because I'm sure they're important to mention this twofold. So first of all, historically, where do we see determinism in Hellenistic culture or in Greek culture? Where does it play itself out? Usually, at least in my mind, I think of the Greek tragedies, right? Where no matter what you do, the world is given, and once the prophecy is given, this is the way it's going to be. But that's not Rav Huttner's main point. Rav Huttner's main point, and he repeats himself in many talks, is that once you think of the human being as a given, then you lose your capacity to believe in freedom of choice. So if we go back to the 60s first, when Huttner was talking about this, and then we'll talk about things that happened after that, because it's almost like a prophecy. So if you remember back in the 60s, what were the deterministic kind of thoughts about human behavior that are around then? Does anybody remember? Skinner, right? The first thing you think of is Skinner. So Skinner, Harry, everything is conditioned. So if you want to give a child who's misbehaving in school some kind of therapy, you will recondition him. And then Skinner took his idea from Pavlov's dogs. The first time I heard Skinner in university, I think it was Psychology 101, I raised my hand and I asked the instructor. I said, "Wait a minute, I don't get it. If everything is our conditioned responses, that would mean that the therapist is giving therapy to the child because of a conditioned response. which would mean that it had absolutely no ethical value. And then he said, well, it helps society. I said, yeah, but all of society are just like Pavlov's dogs. They're just a bunch of beings that have these conditioned responses. So what is the value of all this? So Sarmada said, I think you should go to a philosophy course. He couldn't handle that. So Rav Hunter kind of got this idea that if we look at man like a lab rat in a maze, we're going to get lost. He also had a deep recognition of the fact that once you've made that decision, that doesn't appear in this talk, but once you make the decision you don't have freedom of choice, you lost it. The dice are kind of loaded. If you think there's freedom of choice, there may be freedom of choice. But if you're sure there isn't freedom of choice, then you've lost freedom of choice. So it doesn't play itself out so well. Because once you believe you don't have freedom of choice, you don't act on freedom of choice, and then you've lost it. So the strange thing is that this got much worse. Maybe there's one other thing that he already knew about back then, which is artificial intelligence. You remember in the 60s, I don't know how many people remember here. It looks like a lot of people might remember. First of all, we had 2001 Odyssey in Space. Remember HAL, the computer that goes berserk, I, a robot of Asimov? I don't know if Rafuta read that stuff. He read an awful lot of things. I don't know if he read, I certainly don't think he saw the movie. But artificial intelligence was an issue. Oh, I remember now Huxley also, right? A Brave New World, right? You can have a religious experience. You don't need discipline to have an experience. You can probably just take a pill. Everything is chemical. That might be in his mind as well. He was before social Darwinism, right? Before people started saying that aesthetics and ethics, they were just something that the gene needed to survive. That's what people were saying about 10 years. I don't know how popular it is today, right? If there was a gene, when the tribe had a similar gene pool, so a tribe that developed this, had this mutant gene that gave them the ability to sacrifice or to have altruistic behavior for one another, that gene survived more. So it turned out to be a wonderful trait. So that's why we have altruistic behavior, right? The caveman who had the ability to draw a picture of the hunting scene was able to pass on the ability to hunt better. So that tribe survived more. So those genes survived. That's why we have, so that's how we got Picasso, and that's why we have the Hasidei Umot HaOlam during the Shoah, people who risked their lives to save Jewish people during the Holocaust, and because of genes. I don't know if that plays, but we can work that out. But I'm not going to try to solve it tonight. That's not the point. I think I could solve some of that, but not all of it. And there have been attempts to solve those problems, but it seems like Rav Hunter already knows where this is going. He doesn't want to solve the problem. He simply says, this is where we have a conflict. And the conflict is not between Torah itself, but something that comes before Torah. You cannot have Torah without the idea that the human being is autonomous, has freedom of choice. So this is where we have a conflict. So they complement each other, these cultures, but they also conflict. They complement each other because they both have to do with the way God reveals himself in this world. But they conflict when the scientific approach is applied to human beings themselves. Okay, he doesn't solve the problem. In other words, he doesn't say how we can deal with this. He solves it only in an existentialist way. I'll explain what I mean. In other words, he just says, here we have to take a stand. He doesn't give any solution to the problem. There are many times when he does that. You have to remember, he is an existentialist thinker to some extent, not completely, and very often he takes that mode. He just says, this is where we have to take a stand, and he doesn't explain how we're going to deal with that, with these issues. But he says, here we have to differ with science, and it's going to lead us astray. Okay, so that's Rav Hunter. I think we'll have questions about Rav Hunter, and then we'll talk a little bit about Rav Kook, his mentor to some degree, who has a whole different take on Hellenistic culture, Western culture in this case. Yes?
I mean, it raises to my mind the obvious question of the second belief in a stuff up front of you, as opposed to the Hirach of Sheep. I mean, it sounds like he's totally almost was
or Hashkaah in general. I can't solve that. I will make the problem worse. Okay, there are only for many years there were only two academic articles written about Rav Hunder. They were both written by Professor Stephen in English by Professor Stephen Schwarzschild. Only over the last 5 years have there been people who have been interested in this thought in the academic world. There are people writing doctorates on Rav Hunder, but Professor Schwarzschild thought that Rav Hunder was deeply influenced by Kotsk through Rabbi Tzadok Milublin, Itzbitza. Itzbitza's main point, Hasidut Itzbitza's main point was that he had a fatalistic, deterministic approach to life. So it seems the opposite. When I read this Steve Zorcha was an unbelievable thinker and prolific writer. He wrote over 1,000 articles in general philosophy and another 1,000 in Jewish thought. And his rabbinical training was Reform, but he identified with the conservative movement, but he kept halakha, like any Orthodox Jew, and he was very friendly with Rav Soloveitchik. He once wrote or said to Rav Soloveitchik that you don't write enough. Then Rav Soloveitchik said, you write too much. And in his memoirs, he said, we were both right. So he wrote an awful lot, but when I said this, I said, what are you talking about? He's the Talmid of Samui Sobotka, and Bchira Chofshit, freedom of choice, is one of the main motifs of the Samui Sobotka, and in Rav Hutner, Bchira Chofshit is the main motif, going along with your point of view. He emphasizes Bchira Chofshit time and time again. Especially in on this issue. He also says, and this relates to it, he says, the problem of faith in our day is not faith in God, but rather faith in man. So, if you think of it historically, let's think of a few things that are relevant to that. One, of course, is Darwin, the aftermath of Darwin philosophically. The other is the Shoah, faith in man after the Shoah. And the rest of it is what he discusses here. Right, so that his thought is that to have faith, we have to reclaim our faith in humans and in humankind, and that's where he's at. So I agree with you. I think that he downplays the Hashkacha. But the question, of course, was posed by the Rambam, Yudiyam Bechira, way back when. His emphasis is more, but he does talk about Hashkacha, so much so that even that Stephen Schwarzschild thought that he was almost deterministic in his approach, that everything was controlled by God. Like my Islamic neighbors, Maktub, everything is preordained. So I can't solve the problem. Too complicated. He's also an eclectic thinker, so it's hard to pin, you know, to, he doesn't, he's not systematic. Yes? Okay, I don't know how it affects his approach in Zionism, but he wavered on Zionism a lot. So in the 50s, his students still went to Bnei Akiva. But since he is sort of in the Haredi, we have to remember, I don't know what it's like in Toronto, but the Haredi world of that time, everything was, the lines were not as clear. And all the students of Black Hat Yeshivas went to college. His students did as well. And I learned it from Bach. I didn't come from that world. I came from a different world, probably more like your world, but for all kinds of reasons, sort of default, I studied in Detroit with Rav Bach and went to Wayne State in the evenings. And that was like, even though we snuck out, I hated it. We would sneak out of the Beis Midrash at 20 to 6. The sneaking out bothered me. Everybody went, but they went out one by one. And I couldn't figure that out ever. And also, you couldn't say you enjoyed your secular studies. You weren't allowed to enjoy your secular studies. I never agreed with that. I never played the game. I always said that I enjoyed the secular studies. But so the world is less. I would learn with Rav Bach with the Ranki Pasugan. I was active in Bnei Akiva. And the only thing it was that I had two talks a year were against those who were active in Bnei Akiva. Myself. I was sitting in the room, right? But it's very complicated. And this is a little bit later. Rav Hunder originally was, and he had a picture of Cook in his sukkah. And then at some point he became vehemently anti-Zionist and even accused Zionism of being responsible for part of the Holocaust, like perfidy. He was affected very strongly by Ben Hecht's work, Perfidy. I don't know if you remember all this, where the state of, where the Zionists were in the state of Israel, coming state of Israel, were accused of cooperation with the Nazis. And then, in about, I think it was about 1976 or 77, he started working on coming on Aliyah. He opened a branch of the yeshiva in Israel, and then he was interviewed in Hatzofer, the Mizrahi newspaper, which no longer exists. The Mizrahi barely exists. The newspaper doesn't exist. But then they interviewed him, and they said, what do you say about Zionism? And he said, the Zionists were certainly correct, but we cannot admit it because it's a secular movement. A very typical Rav Huttner kind of hedging. He read everything. They're right, but I can't admit it. But he just admitted it. It's very similar. Rav Huttner did those kind of crazy kind of things. And once a student in one of the classes said something. He said, you read that in Heschel, and then slapped him. So, if you like me, had any part of the Musar movement, you could sort of understand. I don't understand it rationally, but I saw those kind of things going on in my yeshiva as well. Here, I'll give you an example from Bach, so just to get a flavor. One guy, you know, in the Musar movement, people didn't wear their tzitzit out. In fact, the only thing I heard against Rav Huttner when I was a yeshiva student was that he was ostentatious and he acted like a Siddiq Rebbe, and he wore on Shabbat a Bekesh and a Spodik, and that the leadership people didn't like that show. So in Detroit, once one of the guys took out his tzitzit one morning. So I was standing there, so my boss comes up to me and he says, what happened yesterday? You weren't frum? So the guy started putting his tzitzit in. He said, what, you don't have a backbone? So that kind of, you know, people used to ask him, why do you contradict yourself? He said, that's to make sure you think. Right, so, but I think in the end, he became mild again towards Zionism. I think originally he was a Zionist. Or like Hebron. They went to Hebron specifically to be connected to Yeshuva Chadash. They didn't want to be connected to the old timers. They wanted to have an influence in what was going on in Israel then. They weren't exactly Zionists, but they had a connection with what was happening. So, and even today, the Hebroners always say, we're a modern Haredi yeshiva. We say we're more modern. I don't know how it plays itself out, but I think at one time that was quite true. Most of the chief rabbis, the Ashkenazic chief rabbis, and some of the Sephardic chief rabbis went to Hebron. Rav Bakshi Doron learned in Hebron. Okay, we're gonna put that aside for a minute. We're gonna talk a little about Rav Kook. We don't necessarily have to read together because we're running out of time, but I found three paragraphs where Rav Kook that were never printed. I have to say a little bit about Rav Kook. Rav Kook's writings were edited by his students. So for many years, we only had the edited writings. So we could surmise what he really thought, because we could see where he was leading, and sometimes the paragraph sort of petered off, because it was quite clear that his thoughts were much more radical than what we had in print. But we didn't have what he said. So now we can compare. But these particular three paragraphs that talk about Hellenistic culture or Western culture, none of which were censored because none of them were ever chosen by the editors of Rav Kook. None of them. So, does anybody have a guess what Rav Kook would identify as the pinnacle of what's the point of Hellenistic culture? Yeah. I'm talking about what you would think Rav Kook, if you know anything about Rav Kook, what he would think. Anybody? So let's think of that statement. He works on the same statement of Chazal. Yefeifuto shel yefet bo'alei shem. One comes to mind when I say, Yefeifuto shel yefet. Yefeifuto, the beauty of yefet, aesthetics. Rav Kook was very interested in aesthetics. I will tell you about one paragraph to lead into this. That a student of mine, Zichron Ali Vracha, he was later killed in Hebron. His name was Nadav Elad. He noticed that Rav Kook, there are two paragraphs in Rav Kook that we saw in these notebooks. They're called Shmonak Vatzim. The first paragraph, Rav Kook apparently saw a piece of art and he was just enamored with it. He wrote a whole paragraph of just, it's like poetry about art. In the second paragraph, he discusses what the religious significance of art is. And in the second paragraph, he says that the artist has a spark of prophecy, divine inspiration. Okay? When the Nazir, his student, put these together in Orot HaKodesh, he flipped the order of the paragraphs. So that first we get the religious significance, and then we see Rav Kook's poetry about art. So that we never see Rav Kook just reacting to art as a human being. It's already in the religious framework. Whereas in his notebooks, we first see him just reacting to art and then trying to figure out what its religious significance is. So here we have Rav Kook also, he's trying to deal with the ambivalence of our culture towards Hellenistic culture, Western culture, when he identifies Western culture as the emphasis on the aesthetic. So what would you think? Where does that, it's not what you probably wouldn't think. Then you might think about aesthetics as versus ethics. So that you could think of like an issue of Kol B'Shai Erva. Aesthetics more, maybe, somebody would think of it that way. Whereas something comes into conflict between aesthetics, but that's not what he's thinking about. He's thinking about, so he has two paragraphs, I didn't actually bring all of them here. He has two paragraphs where he talks about ambivalence towards the aesthetic world, and his ambivalence is based upon the fact of that the aesthetic world places its emphasis on one of two things. Either plurality, in other words, you see the aesthetics of each object on its own, and as Rav Kook, as a mystic, thinks that the plurality of our reality is a facade, that there really is a oneness. And then he says, this plurality, you can see how that plays itself out with polytheism. The plurality in itself, when we see, because when we go to a museum, or when we look at people and we say, this person is beautiful, or this statue is beautiful, or this flower is beautiful, anytime we pay attention to the aesthetic, we are looking at the object, and we don't see it as an expression of something else. In one place, he talks about the oneness, and the other, he talks about the material world as versus the transcendent. We place a lot of emphasis on what is here, rather than what that which transcends. So then he says, the game should be to get the aesthetic values from Western culture, but to understand that they are expression of something else, either of the transcendent or of the oneness of God. Once we get that, we can then go back and understand the aesthetic value of our own tradition. So he says, if you look at the Tafresh Pei Aleph at Kovetz Aleph, he says, כל מי שמרגיל אותו מסתכל בהערה הלוקית שיש בכל יציאה רוחנית, מוצא הוא את העניין הקדוש שמחיית כל החוכמה. וכל יכול לחבר חוכמת העולם עם התורה ולהכניס גם יפיפיתו של יפת בועלי שם, יפיפיתו של יפת באמת היא יופי של שם. הוד והדר בבית אלוקנו ותפארת ומתן תורה. Rav Kook in one place says that we have lost our appreciation for the aesthetic value of Tanakh. In other words, we learn Tanakh, we think of it in terms of Musar Heskel. No, Ross, help me. What? The lesson to be taught, what the conclusion of the chapter is, but we don't think of the way of its aesthetic value. He said, we lost it because it was associated with others. We should have to bring back aesthetic values into our world. And even our own source material will change. Sometimes when I teach Gemara, at the end I say, look what the editor of the Gemara has done from an aesthetic point of view, how he's the structure of the sugya, how well it's built. It's not something that's normally done. I didn't do it because of course it's just something that I do. Only recently did I discover these paragraphs. But Rav Kook says we have to be wary of putting too much value on the aesthetic because we might lose that which is beyond the aesthetic. So whereas Rav Hutner is concerned with freedom of choice and the value of man, Rav Kook is concerned about losing our religious experience. They both want to incorporate whatever they thought was Western culture. But Rav Hutner thought science and Rav Kook thought aesthetic values, but both are interested in incorporating, but they think we should incorporate it without losing our point. But in Rav Kook, our point is the religious experience or the religious outlook, that they're either the mystical or the religious, depending on which paragraph he wrote. But for him, they're intertwined in his thought because of the way he thinks of the world. Right? He's panentheistic, sometimes even pantheistic. So he thinks of the oneness in our world, and he thinks of the world, and sometimes he thinks of the world even as a facade for something else. So if we lose sense of what's beyond the world, we've gotten lost. It's two different aspects of our culture, which always intertwine in Yahdut, which is one is the transcendent, and the other is the other, a human being and the value of human beings. And those are the two things that they thought could conflict. Each on his own thought that one of these two values could conflict. I think they're both very relevant to our world, both incorporating and understanding. By the way, you notice that once you've done this conceptual kind of analysis of what the Hellenistic world is and the Jewish world is, then you might find out that not everything which seems Hellenistic is, and not everything which seems Jewish or Torah necessarily is. Okay, because if you see this Jewish source material that seems to think that man does not have freedom of choice, I don't know how Rav Huttner would relate to that. I don't know how Rav Huttner would really relate to the Tzbitzer or even to words that we say in the Sephardic Slichot. Halo kol mif'alav k'tuvim b'sefer yamav. All of man's actions are recorded in the book of his days, which seems like Islamic maktub. Everything is written ahead of time, and you're lost. I don't know what Rav Huttner would say if he said Sephardic Slichot. I'm not knocking Sephardic Slichot because the Ashkenazic ones have other problems, but right? And it's only one line, but that one line is like kind of hard to so. And you might think that if you went to a course of ethics and in university and the course of ethics said that there was freedom of choice, that was a Jewish motif from Rav Huttner's point of view. Right, and so you can do the same thing with Rav Kook and see that now we have this conceptual idea of what the cultures are talking about. They don't have to work themselves out in the usual way. Yes, Rakesha. I think you've meshed the two of them together, which is interesting. In other words, I think you've taken the two and you've sort of connected them in a certain way. Rav Kook, you've connected Rav Kook's thought to the idea of ethics. Rav Kook himself, even though he's very concerned with ethics, very concerned with ethics, he says some very strong statement. He said, "Yirat Shemaim Sheina." I don't remember the exact words, but he says when Yirat Shemaim goes against natural morality, it's not Yirat Shemaim. He's very strong in ethics, but in these particular paragraphs, he doesn't connect the two. You made the connection, which is interesting. A physicist told me recently, you know, the Arabs have this idea of maktub, which is like Greek. It's everything is preordained. And in their art, they have patterns that you can only see from afar. So that they seem to imply that there's a great divine harmony of the world. A physicist recently told me that they got the ideas of superstructure from some physicists got the idea from Islamic art, but they saw that there were patterns that in order to fathom the patterns, you had to move further away and see a bigger picture. It was very interesting because there the idea of maktub, something being preordained, which comes from like the Greeks, right? And it expresses itself in art in these wide patterns that you can only see from afar. As if only the divine eye can really understand the patterns. And then physicists started recognizing they were looking for patterns that were too close. You have to take a wider outlook to see, and then they got the ideas of superstructure.
Yes. Yeah, the Mishnah Novot. Yes, we sort of dabbled on that. We could prepare a talk. What?
There's a paradox.
The Rambam thinks it's a paradox. The Rambam thinks it's a paradox. The Rabbi thinks there isn't. And I spent 3 years of high school. There was a fellow who was sure that he had the paradox figured out. Yeah. I recently remembered, like, for 3 years, every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, he would try to convince me once again that he had the paradox figured out. I never could get how he always had a new take on it. So one of my students recently wanted to try to convince me. I said, listen, I don't really feel like going through this again. So for 3 years, he tried to convince me that the Rambam was wrong and the Rambam was right, and he had it all figured out. And I still, it always seems to be a paradox to me. Okay, so we could get to a lot of interesting things related to that. There's because now people like Roger Penrose, who got the Nobel Prize with Hawking, he shows, because in modern physics, sometimes time runs backwards. So that he thinks that solves the problem. When a particle is in acceleration, if you measure it, it changes its behavior. The previous measurement is changed when you measure it afterwards. The mafreya. So it would seem that modern physics shows us that we don't really have the right concept of time. And Penrose thinks that solves the problem of freedom of choice. I don't know. I didn't get it. But if you want to read the book, it makes wonderful reading even if you don't understand. I don't think I really understood the solution, but it was printed like 20 years ago. The Emperor's New Mind. It's called by Roger Penrose. It's very interesting. And if you think it solves the problem, great. Any more questions? Yes.
The Greek culture with aesthetics, I think, is linked to the idea of the perfectibility of man. You see it in the Renaissance, which is supposedly a Renaissance
of Greco-Roman ideas. Yeah. So everybody's made an interesting, tell the truth, I have to think about these ideas, because everybody here seems to be making cross-references between Rav Kook's idea and Rav Hutner's idea. I didn't try that yet. I found about Rav Kook, I discovered these paragraphs of Rav Kook, I discovered about 3 weeks ago. Nobody bothered quoting them. Usually we look at the paragraphs and we look at the prints, the works that have been edited, and then we go back and see what he wrote in the notebooks. But I had a feeling he would talk about aesthetics, so I looked for them, because he has interest in art and aesthetics. So I kind of figured if Yefei Shel Yefet would play itself out that way. In fact, I asked Rav Gilad on the phone. I was trying to quiz him. I said, if you had to think about what Rav Kook would associate with Yavan, what would you say? He thought for 2 minutes, and he said aesthetics. Aesthetics. He thought Rav Gilad got it. You know, he's a student of Rav Kook, so he thought, immediately thought that Rav Kook would think that. I haven't worked them out together. But Rav Kook is concerned about over what you said previously. Rav Kook is very concerned about ideals of perfection and the way they can backfire. He wrote it many times. He said, our idea of tshuva, I'll say it in Hebrew and then in English, is not shleimut, but hishtalmut. We're not trying to reach perfection. We're trying to be in a process of perfecting ourselves, an ongoing process. Right? So that's his way of solving, of getting out of the problem. I have to think about this, because everybody brought these interesting thoughts. I have to think about that. But you should know that Rav Kook had this idea, which I think is very useful in our generation with young people as well. Because when we always try to present, very often Jewish educators, especially Orthodox educators, try to present models that are perfect. And that leads our students to despair or to a feeling that we're not exactly being honest. It doesn't seem honest. Right? Even Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, you know, they wrote a biography of Yaakov Kamenetsky, of the great Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. There were love letters between him and his future wife, and they were censored. That's in the Orthodox world. That's not in the modern Orthodox world. But in the modern Orthodox world as well, we set these paradigms of perfection, and Rav Kook was against that. He thought that we should always talk about people being on the way. We're on our way. Always on our way. Ad mea ve'esrim. We are on the way to perfection, and we will never be perfect. That we don't get into the bind that you were talking about. But I don't know how all this fits together. I have to think about it. If it does at all. Yes, let's go. A balancing.
Yes, that to me is the core of Judaism and why Jews are hated. Because what Judaism is saying is that the equal balance between the female and male energy in order to create this perfection. That is the perfection. That's the yin and the yang. The only place you find this is in Buddhism. That's why I think a lot of Jews gravitate naturally towards Buddhism. So many Jews that go into Buddhism. And I've often asked myself why. This is the reason I think the conclusion I've come to. That is the perfection.
Okay, it just sounds, it's Kabbalic in its nature, and that's beyond the scope of this discussion. Russ?
One last question.
Yes, okay, sure.
Was there, I seem to recall reading Glasner in an introduction to Dora V.E., the same idea about there are rules of human morality which, if they contradict what the Orthodox Jew feels is the dictate of the Torah, then he's got it all wrong. I seem to recall that from Dora V. Glasner. And I'm wondering if there's any relationship between, or any influence between Rav Kook and Glasner.
I would know nothing about it, but it sounds like a quote of Rav Kook. Rav Kook actually says it's... So we could see if there's any connection there. I don't know if there's any connection. I very much agree with Rav Kook on this, except for the concept of natural morality, because I think after the Shoah, it's kind of hard to talk about it in that way. Rav Kook was very optimistic. He thought there was going to be progression, that mankind was naturally good, and then its natural goodness would come out. And I don't know. I think it's kind of harder for us to think of it exactly that way. Okay, Lila Cole.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I want to thank Rabbi Kelvin, who had to step out and pick up his kids. And thank everybody for coming. And thank people for hiring for hosting. And if anybody's
interested in
getting more Torah from Rav Bigman, you can come see me and can take your email. And we send out weekly Divrei Torah.
Bigman.